This is an RNIB Connect radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Toby Davey, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life, from maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might inspire others. My guest today is Selena Mills, an award-winning writer and broadcaster who has worked as a senior reporter and broadcaster for Reuters, The Daily Telegraph and the BBC, to name just a few. On the 13th of July 2023, Bloomsbury published Selena's memoir and history book, Life Unseen, A Story of Blindness, which has received great reviews across the board too. Hello, Selena, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's very exciting.
We're going to start with you, Selena, at I think the age of 10 and listening to a few classical versions of those, that's what I call music LPs that we remember back in the day. And I think most of us may have had sort of those pop versions, but you obviously had a classical version of these wonderful, wonderful compilation LPs. Selena,
I did.
Would you be able to tell me what it was like listening to these sort of classical versions of That's What I Call Music for the first time, and also what sort of home life was like for you at the age of 10?
Well, I think I had always grown up around music. My father loved lots of different music, so did my mum. But I was quite musical, so I had piano lessons when I was very little, and I was playing already at five, so I was quite advanced. And then I had a really lovely godmother who obviously thought education was more important than silly prezzies, and so bought me That's What I Call Music, and there was That's What I Call Mozart. And I do remember vividly, because I spent quite a lot of time on my own actually, and I spent a lot of time just listening to music, and I remember lying on my bedroom floor listening to That's What I Call Mozart. And they're really good recordings. I mean, they were top notch. It wasn't just, sort of tinny or anything like that. And just being blown away from how incredibly beautiful music was, classical music was, and that there were all these different parts of it. There was the violins, and then the drums, and then the flutes, and I loved listening the difference between an oboe and a clarinet. And then I realized you could do that with voices. And that was really, really interesting. And then the piano, I absolutely loved listening to a piano with an orchestra and how it all blended together. And I think that love of classical music has stayed with me ever since. And I still spend a lot of time lying on my sofa listening to the harmonies and the discord as well of classical music. And the piece I've chosen today, which is actually a piece I got married to. I got married in the middle of COVID. And we obviously couldn't have what I wanted, full orchestra and full choir. So I had two singers opposite ends of the church, because, there was me, the vicar, my husband, the pigeon, the organist, and two singers. And they sang this very, very beautiful piece of music by Mozart, which is actually, in a way, quite naughty. It's a philandra trying to lure a young lassie into his arms. It's just the best piece of music ever. It's charming, it's beautiful, and a little bit ominous.
And sort of going back to those sort of early days of listening to Mozart for the first time, I think some of the girls at school might have had Duran Duran and Nick Kershaw and maybe Wham posters on their walls. And you had Sir Simon Rattle and a few classical...
I did! Oh, God, it's so awful. Like, people came in and they're like, who's this guy with woolly hair? And Daniel Barenboim were my pin-ups. And I do remember my mum, when I was having eye operations I was about 10, 11, actually, in LA. And I'd been taken over to this specialist doctor and they were trying to save my sight and drama, drama. And my mum said, OK, let's go and see some classical music to cheer you up. And we go to the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and Sir Simon, when he wasn't Sir Simon then, he was a young whippersnapper trying to make his way. And he was conducting, on the one hand, he was doing Mozart, so we were all like, yay, Mozart. And the other one was, I think it's called Peter Maxwell, who does very, very postmodern classical music. And everybody left, except my mother and I, because I was drooling over Sir Simon. And then afterwards, he played more Mozart. And my mother said she just remembers me yelling really loudly in the auditorium, "Oh my God, it's the Wombles!" And he was playing this piece by Mozart called the Minuetto Allegretto. And it was actually one of the songs that the Wombles had taken and mutated into a song for the Wombles. So yes, I have my childhood is littered with Mozart and Wombles.
A wonderful piece from Mozart's Don Giovanni there, and not only memories that take you back to early life listening to Mozart on classical LPs, but a wonderful memory from your wedding too, Selena. Now we come to a track by the band Pink Martinis, who I think were also undergraduates at university with you in America in the early 1990s. You say that you were lucky to go to study at university in America. Was it a place that you'd always wanted to go to study, and why not sort of study maybe here in the UK?
Well, I actually did study here in the UK for 1 year at the University of London at Holloway, Royal Holloway. And I think what I realised, and so did my tutor, I had a really amazing mentor who is called Jonathan Riley Smith. And he was just the most, he was a medieval historian. And we used to have these hilarious conversations about, you know, why stirrups changed the face of the Crusades. And he was brilliant. And he just said to me that I had not had a very good secondary school education and that I needed to kind of read more, think more. And so I actually went for 1 year to start with. I just went on a scholarship for 1 year. And I just loved it too much that I couldn't go back, and they let me stay. So actually, the system there is very different to Britain. So in Britain, you just do history or just do English or just do physics, whereas in America, you do everything until your last year. And so I was doing things like music, classical music, history, English, physics. What did I do? Oh, semiotics. I mean, I did stuff that I had never even heard of. And I think it really gave me an amazing grounding. But I do remember walking into the common room one day and these guys who were not called the Pink Martinis then, they were just, you know, nice undergraduates. And they were stomping away. It's quite a song that has been recorded before. And it comes from an album called Sympathique. And the words are really funny. That it's, I don't want to work, I just want to sit and eat, and I want to smoke. And it was just such a sort of, it's sort of like, you know, 1930s cafe society, it just takes you there immediately. And yeah, no, I just loved it when I heard it. And it's sort of one of my secret theme tunes, even though actually I'm quite the opposite. I work really, really hard and I get bored if I sit in a cafe too long, and I can't smoke because I'm asthmatic.
And obviously with the track being very much giving that picture of the 1920s and 1930s, is that a period of time that you would have liked to have been around at, or maybe write about?
I think write about, possibly not be in, because blind people would tend to be institutionalised and hidden in corners then. So intellectually, yes, definitely full of really interesting writers, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Vita Sackville West. I mean, just wonderful, wonderful writers, and sort of the end of Henry James's era as well. So it's sort of the end of the Victorians into the early Edwardians. But I don't think I'd like to be alive then. I think blind people were probably treated not so well.
And when you listen to this track, do those sort of memories of undergraduates and common rooms come back to you?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, there was a lot of swimming late at pool parties late at night. And I seem to remember going to a pancake party where I don't know where the pancakes went, but they certainly didn't get eaten. They got flipped everywhere. And it was just, it was a very, you know, when people talk about their undergraduate career life and time, you think, oh, it's, you know, it was so wonderful. But I really did have a great time. I think I was unfurled on the world, and that was it. And America was very, very good on access. I mean, I had so much help. There was enough money to give me an assistant and photocopy staff or an extra large it. And before the internet, we had Apple computers, which were quite early on in those days. And I got one from the university. So my whole life was like, I understood tech for the first time, having not really had it in England. So I think I bloomed in America.
Je ne veux pas travailler. Je ne veux pas déjeuner. Je veux seulement oublier. Et puis je fume. Déjà j'ai connu le parfum de l'amour.
Pink martinis there and memories of university life in America for you, Selena. We now move to Rome and your first job after graduating from university, teaching English to Italian journalists and leading to you becoming a journalist yourself too. Was Rome somewhere that you'd always wanted to go to, and what made you sort of become a journalist? What made you lead into that sort of way of life?
Well, when I got out of university, I went and did this TEFL course, Teaching English as a Foreign Language, and I applied all over the world, and I got two offers. One was from Rome, and one was in São Paulo in Brazil. And I remember talking to my family, and they were all like, okay, why do you want to go to São Paulo? And I did actually want to go there, but I actually thought it was very, very far away. And if it didn't work out, it was a long way to get home, whereas Rome was like 2.5-3 hours on a plane and or a train. And also, I was obsessed with Henry James, very, very sadly. And so I thought, OK, I'll go and be Henrietta James in Rome. And I had to have a job. My father's rule was, I'm not going to financially support you. You've got to go and sort yourself out, mate. So off I went and I got a job at the British Institute of Rome. And I made some fabulous friends there and spent a lot of time eating a lot of pasta and a lot of fruit. Actually, there was just all these markets bulging with beautiful fruit. And I learned Italian, having not spoken it before. I spoke French, so that actually helped a lot because a lot of it was adding an E or an O at the end. But pasta is pasta wherever you go. So, but I was very lucky. And then I was teaching these really lovely journalists from like the leading newspapers in Italy. And I used to analyze the news for them. I'd be like, you know, here's the news story. So what's going on? I would make them talk about it in English with me, but analyze it rather than just translate it. And they were like, oh, you're quite good at this. And I was like, oh, it's really fun. And then one of them introduced me to the bureau chief at Reuters. And he said, well, come and do, you know, a couple of weeks internship and we'll see. It's kind of what happened. And then, I also didn't grow up wanting to be a journalist. I was a bit snotty about it. Because I thought, you know, journalists do nasty things like, you know, reveal people's lives and I didn't realise how much work went into it, and I didn't realise the hierarchy of language and, you know, tone and the structure of a news story. I thought it was very easy, and it actually, you know, people don't realise when they read how much is completely structured. So I did that, and I had this job of reading the newspapers. I had to get up there in my office by 6 a.m. and read all the Italian newspapers, translate them, pricey them, and then put that out on something called The Wire. So it was called The Wire. And news, instead of having the internet, we just put all the news on The Wire. There was Us, you know, Bloomberg, Associated Press, those were the big ones. And that was my job. And then I did it, and I did it quite well. So he offered me a job.
Wow.
So I ended up spending 3 years there and learning a lot about, you know, news, newspapers, and the importance of it as well.
And for somebody who loves music and loves singing as well, and choral singing, obviously Rome is very much a holy city, and of course with the Vatican at the centre, very much a Catholic city, but there are lots of churches and there must have been lots of opportunities to hear wonderful singing in the churches, you know, during Mass and stuff.
Oh, it was extraordinary. I mean, literally anywhere you went, whatever Saint's Day it was, you were like, go past a church. And I lived in the centre of town, actually opposite a statue of someone called Giordano Bruno, who was executed for believing all sorts of things he was allegedly not meant to believe. But there was three churches, huge, massive churches, and I just would walk past them. And Easter, literally the Easter week and after Easter week, you could not stop. I mean, you just, everywhere you went, and it was beautiful. It was free. You just sat there, you listen, you walk out again. And there's this piece by Bach, which I particularly love, from St. Matthew's Passion. And you hear it, and I'm literally transported to another place. And when I hear that sort of music, that sort of choral, formal, liturgical music, you just want to melt. And also, I'm not particularly religious, but had I been, I have to say this is the music that would have converted me.
Johann Sebastian Bach's St. Matthew's Passion there, and it must be wonderful maybe to hear this in one of those churches in Rome too. We're going to stay in Rome for your next chosen track, Selina, which I think is looking back on those 4 years that you were in Rome. You say that you really learnt to become an adult in Rome. And I wondered what would you say turned you into becoming more of an adult and possibly more passionate about life during those 4 years in Rome?
I think Rome is a very passionate city. I mean, everybody talks with their hands. Everyone is constantly out eating and drinking and celebrating life. And if you're religious, you might be in a church doing it. If you're agnostic, you might be in a restaurant doing it, or both. But also, it's just so beautiful. I mean, everywhere you go is beautiful. And so you feel very present. You almost don't look to the future because you're so very much in the present, even though the present is based on the past. But it's an odd mix. It's a cacophony of architecture, and you basically get every moment of your day is full. And I think I learned to be a grown-up. What I mean by that is, I didn't have a university campus to support me. I didn't have friends. I didn't have a language to start with. And I did everything from scratch. And I learned to cook for myself. I learned to manage my home. I learned to get to work. I learned to also think about my eyesight and how to handle that, because a lot of religious people would see, if I ever took my cane out, people would grab my cheeks and pray for me, which was a little bit much, I have to say. because I'm like, who are you? Why are you grabbing my face? You know, please stop grabbing my face. So I felt very, I think I learned my own internal notions of blindness, or what I wanted to refer to myself as. And I did make some friends, and funnily enough, some priests who did not pinch my cheeks. And there was one guy called Father Reginald Foster who taught Latin for free in the afternoons. And a group of us would go just for fun, as you do, to learn Latin in the Vatican. And, you know, he was a secretary, personal private secretary to the Pope. And so he would let us all in and we all sit there learning away. And I just sort of realized, he once took me to the Vatican Library and showed me decretals. He'd had them blown up onto a huge page for me. And they were decretals by this man who, he was called Dr. Caius, something like Octillissimus or something, which basically means a blind but far-seeing doctor. And he was trying to show to me, and he said, like, I want you to know that it doesn't matter whether you see or don't see, you still have a mind and you still must use it. And I always thought that was rather beautiful.
Wow. And I think there are sort of places and times that really can affect you and be a turning point in your life. And it sounds as if Rome was very much a turning point in your life.
I think so. I didn't realise, you know, you probably don't realise it at the time. And I certainly didn't, you know, as earlier I was saying, I didn't really want to grow up thinking, oh, I'll be a journalist. But I definitely realised that the things that I'm good at sort of work very, very well with journalism. So like talking to random strangers, because I always would do that, and not being afraid to ask and not being afraid to talk about difficult things that suit journalism quite well. And discipline, sort of doing your research, doing your homework. I like that too. So no, I was really lucky. It was the right place at the right time.
So Selina, what is the track that sums up those 4 years for you in Rome? And is there something about the singer perhaps too?
So there was a friend of mine said, you know, as a sort of goodbye present, she would take me to see this pop singer who I love called Eros Ramazzotti. And Eros is still very popular in Italy. It's also a wave to my tacky side. So I'm very busy going on Mozart and Bach and everything. And then there's Eros. And Eros sings a song which is very famous in Italy called Più bella cosa di te. There's nothing more beautiful than you. And I think that's how I feel about Rome. It's just such a great song. And everyone was like, you know, we were all in the, what was it called? The Circus Maximus, which is this big area at the back of Rome. And we were with our phones with our lights on, waving our hands in the air. You know, it was total tackville. And I loved every moment of it. And I still, when I hear that piece of music, I'm Italian. And I just want to live there and never come home.
Come è cominciata io non saprei, la storia è infinita con te.
Eros Ramazzotti there, and a track that I wouldn't even try to pronounce in Italian because I wouldn't be able to do it justice. We are now going to focus on the power of music and words with a piece from the opera Orpheus and Eurydice by Gluck. Selina, the first time that you heard this piece of music was very much in a sort of stripped down version with no big set, no big costumes, and very much a pared down version of this piece of music. What was that sort of experience like for you hearing this piece of music in that way?
I love this piece of music, and every time I hear it, it's anew. I did first hear it in a park in the summer in Berlin. I have a lovely friend there, one of my dearest friends in the world. And I love this about the German culture, which is that there's music everywhere and it's not expensive, mostly free. It's everywhere. And she said, oh, no, let's just go to the park. They're putting on Orpheus and Eurydice. And I'm like, oh, I don't know what that is. And I just sat there and I thought, this is so brilliant. So they were all running around in sheets. They were student opera singers. And there was, you know, a small quintet, I think, of violins and a harpsichord. And it's the story of a fellow going down to Hades to rescue his girl, Eurydice, and all the toils he has to overcome to get her. And similar to the biblical story, he is told, go and get her. And when you bring her out, don't look back. Just keep going because she will follow you. And he could not bear to make sure she was there. And she kept going, Orpheus, Orpheus. You know, she was like moaning. And he looked back, and in some versions he dies and in some versions he doesn't. But sitting on the grass, looking at a load of kids in sheets was just phenomenal. And I think that's the power of music, is that you can be anywhere at any time and it doesn't matter. And it also is, I really wanted to have an affectionate nod to my darling friend in Germany because she's been like my second sister all my life. So I just wanted to make sure she comes with me on my magical musical journey.
Orpheus and Eurydice by Gluck there, and the wonderful power of music and words and opera too. We now come to a track that you have dedicated to your dad, who sadly passed away, I think, 4 years ago. From your sort of, I suppose, own experience of growing up as a visually impaired person, how supportive was your dad to you? Because I know for myself, as somebody who grew up with very supportive parents and brothers and stuff, I know how important, you know, that sort of support and encouragement there is from family members.
Absolutely. I think both of my parents were incredibly impressed, or rather impressed upon me, that I should be independent. And they didn't want me to be treated differently simply because I couldn't see very well. to the point that they made me learn to drive. And a lot of people were like, oh my God, you're letting like this half blind kid drive. But luckily it was not on the main road. It was on a farm, a granny's farm. And I did learn to drive. And their theory being, you never know when you're going to be in a car and somebody has a heart attack and you might need to drive. I was like, okay, why not? But I learned to ski. I learned to water ski. I learned to windsurf. They used to have to come and rescue me because I would get lost. But there was a definite push to help me be independent. And when I went to America, they were totally for it. They're like, yep, you're 19, you go for it, go fly. And my sister also is, I'm very lucky that I have a sibling who never treated me any differently from anyone else. And I think having a supportive family life really makes a huge difference. And it also can have backfire. So, you know, my parents were very much into independence, but it also means it took me a while to realize I did have limits. We all have limits. And so I had to sort of learn to stop faking, not seeing. I was very good at faking it. And I think my father understood that, actually. I remember we used to go for long walks together and he was like, no, you need to know your limits. We all have limits. And, you know, but I think he was very tall. He was 6'10". So I felt very protected by him. And he was also had a really funny sense of humour. And we used to giggle a lot. You know, I remember once he was trying to help pick apples from a tree because he was the tall one, so he didn't need a ladder. And I can't remember what happened, but we got the giggles and he actually had to sit down and laugh because he was laughing so hard with my cousins. And I just, that my image of him is somebody who's just was full of life, very funny, a little bit naughty, but also very wise. And when I started writing my book, I said, Dad, you know, do you think I should do this? Because I'm really not going to be working at a full-time job. And he was like, you won't know until you try. And I always thought that was, you know, such great supportive advice.
I think that is the case, isn't it? Is to have somebody who is there to support you and give you that very wise advice, but also somebody who's able to say, you know, sort of, you've done your best job at something, and to be honest with you, and say, you know, sort of, now it's time to sort of maybe think of something else.
yes, that driving lesson, we might stop that now. No, but my mum was like that too. She would always say, you know, I think I failed my English A level. No, not A level. What's the one?
GCSE.
Yeah, I got a C, and I really knew I was able to do more. And she's like, well, go and do it again. Go on, off you go. And like, I always thought that was quite, you know, I think she has a, was it give it a go, Joe, was some of her phrasing. And I think I'm lucky that, and both of my sister and I both feel, you know, blind or not, we had parents who were like, go fly, go to America, go to Rome, become a journalist, don't let anything stop you. And I think, you know, that it was good for women as well, particularly to feel that they had that freedom, because I think definitely 70s and 80s, you know, not all parents were like that.
Selena, your dad loved classical music, but he also liked country music too. And I think you've chosen a Kenny Rogers track to dedicate him. which track and why?
I've chosen The Gambler, mostly because we all knew the words and we all sat in the car driving, you know, to France in the summer and going, you know when to roll them, know when to fold them. Anyway, I won't sing, but it was really very much him. So like, on the one hand, you'd listen to, you know, Dvorak and Sibelius and like all these heavy big orchestral pieces, and that was sort of, you know, him. And then we'd have this sort of American thing going on with Dolly Parton and Bobby Bear and Kenny Rogers and Johnny Cash as well. And he used to take us, he took us to see Johnny Cash at the Hammersmith Apollo. I mean, how cool is that? So The Gambler is Kenny Rogers giving, it's a story of a gambler, and he gives advice to somebody. And actually the advice is good in all aspects of life. You know when to roll them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away and know when to run. And it's like, maybe that's about, you know, the limits of your life as well as the good moments, and when to, was it, don't count your money sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. And it's true. It's like, you know, don't show off. Don't anticipate everything in as if you were the one to get it. You know, you don't know. So I miss him, and I miss his wisdom, and I miss his very, very big hugs. They were huge hugs because he was so tall. And I definitely wanted to have some sort of country and Western music as a track for him.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
Kenny Rogers there, and a track dedicated to your father, Selena. We now come to your final track, Selena, one that you might like to pass on that could possibly inspire other people. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
I think this is to keep you going. Often when I get stuck writing, I play this piece of music. It's Beethoven. It's the Piano Concerto number 3. And I think it's the first movement. But halfway through the first movement, you've got to get to the yearning bit. And I just think there's never enough Beethoven in your life. And if I had a choice, I would have, you know, 3 more tracks, which are Beethoven, because he is just the most phenomenal composer. And when I get stuck writing, I just go and listen to some Beethoven. You know, it can be anything from his chamber music to his orchestral music. But this piece in particular shows you that you can change a mood in a second. You can go from, you know, major to minor, and or you can change the rhythm, you can slow down, you can speed up. And I think writing's like that too, so, and life too. You feel that sometimes you're like racing ahead and doing really, really well, and it's all very positive. And then literally you come home and the cat's died. And you just think, oh. And I think Beethoven captures the wide variety of the human spirit and in all its elements. And I find that very, in a way, humane and helpful, because it carries you forward. Because we're all there. We're all in this big pot of confusion. And it's okay. We will find our way out somehow. And I think it's definitely the piece I want at my funeral. It's definitely a piece I listen to in hard times, but it's also a piece I listen to in good times. So I think it's really important to know pieces of music like this. It doesn't have to be Beethoven. For me, it is, but for other people. But to know something that it reassures you of your humanity. And I think Beethoven does that for me.
Well, what a wonderful piece of music to finish on. And thank you very much indeed, Selena Mills, for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's been an utter pleasure. Thank you.